Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily Camera and Longmont Times Call, read by Anita Head. This is being recorded on Monday, April 29th, 2024. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Gaza, Leaders Discuss Potential Ceasefire by Tia Goldenberg, John Gambrill, and Sammy Magdi. Police Survey, Hiring in U.S. is Up After Years of Decline by Claudia Lauer. Boulder Embraces the Whimsy of Life by Andrea Grajeda. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Gaza, Leaders Discuss Potential Ceasefire by Tia Goldenberg, John Gambrill, and Sammy Magdi, The Associated Press, Tel Aviv, Israel. The White House on Sunday said U.S. President Joe Biden had again spoken with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as pressure builds on Israel and Hamas to reach a deal that would free some Israeli hostages and bring a ceasefire in the nearly seven-month-long war in Gaza. The White House said that Biden reiterated his clear position as Israel plans to invade Gaza's southernmost city of Rafah, despite global concern for more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering there. The U.S. opposes the invasion on humanitarian grounds, straining relations between the allies. Israel is among the countries U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will visit as he returns to the Middle East on Monday. Biden also stressed that progress in delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza be sustained and enhanced, according to the statement. The call lasted just under an hour, and they agreed the onus remains on Hamas to accept the latest offer in negotiations, according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because the official wasn't authorized to comment publicly. There was no comment from Netanyahu's office. A senior official from key intermediary Qatar, meanwhile, urged Israel and Hamas to show more commitment and more seriousness in negotiations. Qatar, which hosts Hamas headquarters in Doha, was instrumental along with the U.S. and Egypt in helping negotiate a brief halt to the fighting in November that led to the release of dozens of hostages. But in a sign of frustration, Qatar this month said it was reassessing its role. An Israeli delegation is expected in Egypt in the coming days to discuss the latest proposals in negotiations, and senior Hamas official Bassem Naim said in a message to the Associated Press that a delegation from the group will also head to Cairo. Egypt's state-owned Al Kahira News satellite television channel said that the delegation would arrive on Monday. The comments by Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson Mahid Al-Ansari in interviews with the liberal daily Haaretz and Israeli public broadcaster Khan were published and aired Saturday evening. Al-Ansari expressed disappointment with Hamas and Israel, saying each side has made decisions based on political interests and not with civilians' welfare in mind. He didn't reveal details on the talks other than to say they have effectively stopped, with both sides entrenched in their positions. Al-Ansari's remarks came after an Egyptian delegation discussed with Israeli officials a new vision for a prolonged ceasefire in Gaza, according to an Egyptian official who spoke on a condition of anonymity to freely discuss developments. The Egyptian official said that Israeli officials are open to discussing establishing a permanent ceasefire in Gaza as part of the second phase of a deal. Israel has refused to end the war until it defeats Hamas. The second phase would start after the release of civilian and sick hostages and would include negotiating the release of soldiers, the official added. Senior Palestinian prisoners would be released and a reconstruction process launched. Negotiations earlier this month centered on a six-week ceasefire proposal and the release of 40 civilians and sick hostages held by Hamas in exchange for freeing hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. A letter written by Biden and 17 other world leaders urged Hamas to release their citizens immediately. In recent days, Hamas has released new videos of three hostages, an apparent push for Israel to make concessions. The growing pressure for Hamas and Israel to reach a ceasefire deal is also meant to avert an Israeli attack on Rafah, the city on the border with Egypt, where more than half of Gaza's 2.3 million population is seeking shelter. Israel has massed dozens of tanks and armored vehicles. The planned incursion has raised global alarm. Only a small strike is all it takes to force everyone to leave Palestine, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asserted to the opening session of the World Economic Forum in Saudi Arabia, adding that he believed an invasion would happen within days. But White House National Security spokesman John Kirby told ABC that Israel assured us they won't go into Rafah until we've had a chance to really share our perspectives and concerns with them. So we'll see where that goes. The Israeli troop buildup may be also a pressure tactic on Hamas in talks. Israel sees Rafah as Hamas's last major stronghold. It vows to destroy the group's military and governing capabilities. Aid groups have warned that an invasion of Rafah would worsen the already desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza, where hunger is widespread. About 400 tons of aid arrived Sunday at the Israeli port of Ashdod, the limit largest shipment yet by sea via Cyprus, according to the United Arab Emirates. It wasn't immediately clear how or when it would be delivered into Gaza. Police survey. Hiring in U.S. is up after years of declines by Claudia Lauer, the Associated Press, Philadelphia. Police departments across the United States are reporting an increase in their ranks for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic and the 2020 killing of George Floyd, which led to a historic exodus of officers, a survey shows. More sworn officers were hired in 2023 than in any of the previous 4 years, and fewer officers overall resigned or retired, according to the 214 law enforcement agencies that responded to a survey by the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF. Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police officers spurred nationwide protests against police brutality and heightened scrutiny of law enforcement. As more and more officers left, many of the departments had to redeploy stretched resources by shifting officers away from investigative work or quality of life issues, such as abandoned vehicles or noise violations, to handle increases in crime. And in some cases, the shortages meant slower response times or limiting responses to emergencies only, police officials said. I just think that the past 4 years have been particularly challenging for American policing, said Chuck Wexler, executive director of PERF, a nonprofit policing think tank based in Washington, D.C., and our survey shows we're finally starting to turn a corner. Individual departments are turning that corner at different rates, however, according to Wexler, who noted that many are still struggling to attract and keep officers. As a whole, the profession isn't out of the woods yet, he said. The Associated Press left phone and email messages with several unions and police departments to ask about increased hiring. The survey shows that while small and medium departments had more sworn officers than they did in January 2020, large departments are still more than 5% below their staffing levels from that time, even with a year-over-year increase from 2022 to 2023. The survey also showed smaller departments with fewer than 50 officers are still struggling with a higher rate of resignations and retirements. The survey asked only for numbers, Wexler said, so it's hard to say whether those officers are leaving for larger departments or leaving the profession altogether. He also said smaller departments, which account for 80% of agencies nationwide, were underrepresented in the responses PERF received. Many larger departments have increased officer pay or started offering incentives such as signing bonuses for experienced officers who are willing to transfer, something smaller departments can't really compete with. At least a dozen smaller departments have disbanded, leaving the municipalities they once served to rely on state or county for help, or state or county help for policing. But even some of the highest paying large departments are still struggling to get new hires in the door. I don't think it's all about money. I think it's about the way people perceive their job and feel they are going to be supported, Wexler said. You have West Coast departments that are paying six figures but still seeing major challenges in hiring. In addition to pay and bonuses, many agencies are reexamining their application requirements and hiring processes. Wexler believes some of those changes make sense, including allowing visible tattoos, reweighing the importance of past financial issues, and processing applicants' background checks faster. But he cautioned that PERF does not support lowering standards for training or for applicants. Maria Maki Haberfeld, chair of the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, said departments have been too focused on officer numbers. She worries some are lowering education requirements and other standards to bolster numbers instead of trying to find the best people to police their communities. Policing is a real profession that requires more skills and more education than people can understand, she said. It's not about tattoos or running a mile in 15 minutes. It's really more about emotional intelligence, maturity, and making those split-second decisions that don't use deadly force. Haberfeld also cautioned that any staffing gains made through incentives could easily be erased, especially as officers, including some in riot gear, have been seen breaking up protests against the Israel-Hamas war at universities across the country. In policing, it takes decades to move forward and a split second for the public attitude to deteriorate, she said. PERF's survey showed a more than 20% drop in resignations overall, from a high of almost 6,500 in 2022 to fewer than 5,100 in 2023. They are still up over early pandemic levels in 2020, however, when a few more than 4,000 officers resigned across all responding departments. As with the hiring increases, the rate of decrease in retirements tended to depend on the size of the departments. There were fewer retirements in 2023 than in 2019 at large departments, slightly more retirements at medium departments, and elevated retirements at small departments. The survey found a steep drop in resignations at large agencies with 250 or more officers and medium-sized agencies with between 50 and 249 officers. In addition to pay and benefit increases, the improved retention can be partly attributed to a shift in how some public officials view their public safety departments, Wexler said. We went from having public discourse about defunding the police just a few years ago to public officials waking up to the fact that their workforce is leaving, he said. I don't think there's any question that there has been a sea change among political leaders. Tulip, Fairy, and Elf Festival. Boulder embraces the whimsy of life. By Andrea Grajeda. Hundreds of people welcome spring with open arms and fairy wings during the Tulip, Fairy, and Elf Festival on Pearl Street. The Sunday festival had dozens of activities for kids and live musical performances to welcome the 15,000 tulips along Boulder's Pearl Street Mall. Chesalon Piccone, a volunteer at the festival, said that she first came across the festival last year. She was confused why she had run into so many fairy wings that day, but she thought the event was incredibly cute and she wanted to be involved. I think in Boulder there is an acceptance of fantasy without making it illicit. You can just be fun, Piccone said. Alongside the festival being unapologetically whimsical, Piccone said the festival is also unabashedly feminine. She explained that as people grow up and people get evaluated as adults, people learn to become insecure and it becomes easy to let go of things that will provoke others to not take someone seriously. Rosalie, the Rose Fairy, known by her human name Rebecca Wolverton, or as Wandering Rabbit Cosplay, said that the Tulip Festival is one of her favorite days of the year, as it is a great opportunity to show off her wings. The world is so gloomy and there are so many things to be sad about, Wolverton said. Sometimes you need to just budget out a day for joy. She said that the festival is about embracing whimsy, creativity, and not letting people tell you who you aren't, even if that someone is a fairy. Jennifer James, dressed as the fairy Meadow, described herself as always having been a bit of a goblin, as she loves snails, butterflies, flowers, and greenery. Her fairy persona has the name Love of Nature. I think we lose touch with nature and our connection and being part of it, James said. She said that having events such as the Tulip Festival is a great way to reconnect with the same feelings someone may have had as a child when they still believed in magic. Aurora, city finalizes $80 million farm purchase as it seeks more water, by Elise Schmelzer. The legality of Aurora's $80 million purchase of a farm and its water rights is disputed by leaders in southeastern Colorado, who say that the deal violates a two-decade-old agreement to stop the booming suburban city from using water meant for crops. Aurora city officials on April 18th finalized the deal to buy a 5,475-acre farm and its water rights in rural Otero County. The city will lease out the property for farming most of the time, though it can draw on the water rights to fill its reservoirs 3 out of every 10 years under the terms. Now home to about 400,000 people, the state's third largest city estimates its population will grow 40% over the next two decades. That new, larger population would increase the city's water needs by an estimated 26%. The farm purchase was necessary to help expand water supply for the city's future, said Alexandra Davis, Aurora Water's Assistant General Manager of Water Supply and Demand. The water rights could provide 22,500 acre-feet of water to the city every 10 years, or enough water for 45,000 families for a year. Our philosophy is that we're trying to get all the water we need now, even if we don't need it for 30 or 40 years, Davis said. It's going to be much harder down the road than it is today, and it's already hard today. The Front Range City draws about a quarter of its water from the Arkansas River, which flows from the river's headwaters near Leadville to Pueblo, then across the southeastern corner of the state toward Kansas. Aurora purchased swaths of Arkansas River Valley farms in the 1970s and 80s for access to the farm's water rights. The farms were then fallowed, a practice known now as buy and dry, that can decimate rural communities reliant on irrigated farming. Those purchases in part spurred a 2003 agreement between Aurora and the Southeastern Colorado Water Conservancy District, which manages infrastructure that brings water to southeastern Colorado. The agreement bans Aurora from purchasing and permanently transferring water to the city from the basin. It also states that Aurora can lease water from the basin 3 out of every 10 years if the city's storage reservoirs are at 60% or less of capacity as of March 15th of the year in question. The Water Conservancy District contends that the Otero County farm purchase violates that agreement. It's a permanent purchase of water to be transferred out of the basin in some years, said Bill Long, the district's president. In my mind, there's no question that this is outside what we agreed to do, said Long, who helped negotiate the 2003 agreement. Even though it's 3 of 10 years, it's still a dry up. It's a rotational dry up. But Davis said the water won't be permanently transferred out of the basin as it will be used for farming and in most years. The land will be used to grow livestock feed, according to a statement from CNA Companies, a Denver area real estate company that sold the land to Aurora and will lease out the land in the years it is available for agriculture. If the current farming operation that's contracted to use the land goes out of business, Davis said, the city will seek a new lesser leaser to farm it. Aurora has attempted in past arrangements to lease water from farmers in dry years, but has found that difficult. Crop prices rise in a dry year, which incentivizes farmers to plant instead of leasing water, Davis said. It's also difficult for farmers to dry up land without extensive notice. The Otero County purchase is a win-win for the farm and the city, Davis said, and it's a potential blueprint for future deals in other river basins. But the Conservancy District isn't giving up. Long said the district and the city plan to meet to discuss the purchase in coming weeks. If they can't resolve their differences, he said, the district will consider legal action. We'll utilize whatever remedies are available to help us resolve this issue, Long said. That's our responsibility. Removing water from a region reliant on farming sets in motion a snowballing set of negative economic consequences, Long said. Less water means less farming. Less farming means fewer jobs and less money flowing into the local businesses that sell farming equipment. Fewer jobs and fewer farm businesses mean less spending at restaurants, less tax revenue, and eventually population loss. When we take water out of the Arkansas Valley to build homes in Aurora, what are the benefits to our taxpayers, Long said. Mental health. State changing who answers 988 suicide crisis line by Meg Wingerder. Colorado is ending its contract with the organization that answers local calls to the national 988 lifeline, but state officials haven't said why or who will take over the suicide and crisis line. Rocky Mountain Crisis Partners currently answers calls to both 988 and the state's 844-493-8255 TALK suicide prevention hotline, but its contract is scheduled to end June 30th. The Colorado Behavioral Health Administration has issued a notice of intent to contract with another organization, but won't release information about it until it finalizes the agreement. Rocky Mountain Crisis Partners, which has more than 400 employees, has held the 988 contract in Colorado since the new number rolled out in 2022 and has run the state crisis line since 2011. The state procures services regularly to ensure state funds are issued in a transparent and competitive manner. It is common practice for agencies to conduct a full procurement process when a contract ends, spokeswoman Stephanie Bush said in a statement. Rocky Mountain Crisis Partners CEO Bev Marquez declined to comment, but multiple employees reached out to the Denver Post expressing concerns about their jobs and the effects that a change in provider could have on Lifeline callers. All spoke on the condition of anonymity because they hoped to work for a new contractor. A woman who works as peer support specialist for the crisis line said she worries that callers who are accustomed to talking to particular people won't adjust well to unfamiliar voices on the other end of the phone. Some people who aren't in touch with their families and lack other support call 988 multiple times a day, including one who has schizophrenia and relies on the crisis line to help him stay calm and sort through what's real, she said. Some of them, we are all they have, she said. In July 2022, the federal government rolled out the 988 Lifeline, replacing the harder-to-remember National Suicide Prevention Line, though calls to the old number still go through. The National Association of Counties estimated Americans have made about 7 million calls to the new number. Overall, the line has been relatively successful, answering a higher percentage of calls in a shorter time than the old crisis line did, despite the increase in call volume, according to the health-focused nonprofit KFF. Results varied by state, though. In March, Colorado centers answered about 77% of 988 calls, which was the 10th lowest rate in the country, according to data from Lifeline. State centers have a goal of answering 95% of calls, according to Stat News, though only three states managed that in March, the most recent month with data. If someone can't answer a call in state, it rolls to the national backup center. Boulder-based media producer highlights climbers' raw experience. People are fascinated by anyone at the top of their game, John Glassberg told me last week. Trying to understand how they think, how they act, and what makes them good, it's compelling. When we spoke on the phone, he and Jess Glassberg, his wife and business partner, were overseas working 12 to 14-hour days on multiple photo and video shoots with professional climbers from Slovenia, France, and Japan. The athlete profiles they're producing will be used for the Olympic Games in Paris this summer. John Glassberg is the founder and owner of Boulder-based production company Louder Than 11. He has been photographing and filming climbers for nearly 30 years, with a gift for revealing authenticity in his subjects in a raw and honest way. The real look into someone's life behind the scenes is cool, he said. I love that because you get to show how these people are real, but also exceptionally talented. Speaking of talent, Glassberg and his company are flourishing in a business where most have failed. He says luck has played a big role, but anyone who knows him would point out his relentless drive and determination. A self-described obsessed workaholic, his perfectionist tendencies produce exceptional results. The same could be said of his climbing career, defined by decades of high-level bouldering up to V15, a world-class level of difficulty. Perhaps just as impressive is his volume of double-digit boulders, that is, V10 and harder. He has climbed more than 600 of them, including dozens of first ascents up to V13. But Glassberg's road to success has been anything but easy. Every breakthrough in his work in climbing has come at the price of failures, near misses, and add. Glassberg started climbing in Virginia at 11 years old. He competed indoors, earned sponsorships, then shifted his focus to outdoor bouldering. After exhausting his local boulders, where he established more than 100 new problems, he traveled the country on a shoestring. I would beg my sponsors for $200 to go on a three-week trip somewhere. It was desperate times, he said, laughing. During that time, digital cameras evolved to shoot both photos and video. I would shoot a bunch of video of my friends climbing, then stay up till 1 a.m. editing. Then I would publish it on the web, which was also kind of new. Suddenly, 5,000 people have watched it, and you're like, whoa, this is sick. People seeing this stuff? I saw the power of it really quickly. In 2008, he and a friend started Louder Than 11 with the goal of filming climbing and providing those films for free. That was the only thing we cared about, that everyone could see what we were making without any restrictions, said Glassberg. We just put our heads down and did as much media creation as we possibly could. As Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and Vimeo really blew up, we were just riding that wave. Their noble mission didn't exactly pay off at first. We made no money for a really long time, Glassberg said. I worked as a full-time route setter at the spot in Boulder for 3 or 4 years, and I had all these side jobs to make end meet. Back then, he couldn't have imagined that 16 years later in 2024, he and his wife and babies would make a living traveling the globe, producing commercial media, as well as personal stories, his favorite for clients such as Google, Adidas, and The North Face, or that his work would be viewed by hundreds of millions of people who watch the Olympic Games. Yet Glassberg's mission and motivation remain refreshingly simple. "It's really special," he said, "to tell these stories of amazing people and to show the mainstream what climbing is about because it's cool." Police investigate reports of shots fired Weber Hall at CU Boulder by Andrea Grajeda. The University of Colorado Police Department has suspects in custody after a report of shots fired in the Williams Village neighborhood early Sunday morning. In an online alert, the police say there were no serious injuries and there is no threat to the campus. About 3 a.m., officers responded to a noise complaint at Weber Hall. As police were breaking up a large party, there was reports of shots fired in a parking lot outside, CUPD announced. CUPD identified and apprehended suspects who were taken into custody. There were no serious injuries reported. Police had instructed residents to shelter in place during the incident, lifting the shelter in place by 5:25 a.m. More information is available at alerts.colorado.edu. Earth Week, Diary of a Changing World by Steve Newman. Week ending Friday, April 26, 2024. Hot-cold paradox. The outbreaks of unusually cold and even unseasonably Arctic blasts that have recently chilled people living in the middle latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere are predicted to intensify for the remainder of this decade, despite the ongoing record warming of the Arctic. Scientists at China's Guangzhou Institute of Science and Technology say these warm Arctic cold continent, WACC, events are merely the start of a drastic shift in climate that will only strengthen in the decades ahead. Climate expert Jin Ho Yoon says models predict the WACC events will decline sharply after the 2030s, but they will still cause more severe consequences when they do occur. Earthquakes. Dozens of aftershocks of eastern Taiwan's destructive magnitude 7.2 quake on April 3rd rocked buildings and rattled nerves in the quake-weary region. Earth movements were also felt in New Zealand's North Island, northwestern Iran, and central Turkey. Marine life slump. Record-breaking ocean heat of the past year appears to have brought an unprecedented decline in phytoplankton, algae, and bacteria, which many marine species depend upon for food. A study by Marshall Bowles at Louisiana universities and colleagues elsewhere studied 21 years of satellite data and found that by April of 2023, there had been a 22% drop in the microorganisms compared to the 21-year average. The study found that almost three-quarters of the global ocean surface saw such a decline. Zoe Jacobs at Britain's National Oceanography Center, who was not involved in the study, told New Scientist that marine ecosystems can usually recover from brief drops, but she said the findings are very concerning. Dream songs. Argentine scientists say they have been able to extract songs from the minds of sleeping birds and generate audible versions of them in the lab. Based on how vocal muscles move when birds are sleeping, it has long been thought that they are dreaming about singing during their slumber. Physicist Gabriel Mindlin at the University of Buenos Aires and colleagues converted the muscle movements of several great kikadees into songs and were shocked at how similar they were to real bird songs. Penguin peril. Climate change is occurring faster than some emperor penguin colonies in Antarctica can permanently adapt, and a new study says that record low sea ice levels last year contributed to the second worst year for chick mortality on record. Researchers at the British Antarctic Survey say last year's penguin chick deaths followed a catastrophic breeding failure in 2022. While some colonies fled to icebergs, ice shelves, or more stable sea ice to survive, lead researcher Peter Fretwell says this is only a temporary solution and the birds can adapt only so much to a warming climate. Sinking China. Chinese researchers warn that a quarter of their country's coastal land will sink below sea level within the next century, putting hundreds of millions of people at risk of flooding. Writing in the journal Nature, they say the subsidence is the result of unbridled groundwater pumping and the sheer weight of buildings being constructed as urbanization increases. The report also says that nearly half of all major Chinese cities are sinking. Extreme heat, deadly heat. Extreme heat of up to 119 degrees Fahrenheit that has caused numerous deaths from the Sahara to Nigeria in recent weeks was made more acute by greenhouse gas emissions warming the climate, experts say. Heat waves with magnitudes observed in March and April 2024 in the region would have been impossible to occur without the global warming of 1.2 degrees Celsius to date, the World Weather Attribution Academic Collaboration reported. We'll now be reading an editorial. Only dictators have immunity from criminal acts while in power. It seems unlikely that the Supreme Court will embrace Donald Trump's outrageous claim that as a former president, he enjoys absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions that he allegedly took to overturn the 2020 election and cling to power. This is a relief. To do so otherwise would allow the office to become, as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson put it, the seat of criminal activity in this country. Ominously, however, some conservative justices during Thursday's oral argument expressed exaggerated concerns about prosecuting former presidents. That raises the possibility that the case might be returned to the lower courts for a determination of which of Trump's alleged actions constituted official acts, a category Trump's lawyers have defined broadly. Such a muddled outcome would be a mistake, and not only because it would make it less likely that Trump would be put on trial before the November election. If the justices focus on the allegations against Trump, they can and should rule there should be no protection for criminal conduct just because it is connected in some way to the president's official duties. Understandably, some questions focused on the future implications of a ruling denying Trump immunity. For example, Justice Neil M. Gorsuch expressed a concern about future uses of the criminal law to target political opponents based on accusations about their motives. He noted that the court would be writing a rule for the ages. Of course, the justices should think about the consequences of their decisions, but the primary focus in this case should be on whether Trump is entitled to immunity for the specific actions he allegedly took in an attempt to overturn the election. The answer should be no. Allowing the most powerful person in the nation, if not the world, to operate without any fear of prosecution for, say, ordering the murder of a political opponent or throwing out election results is a recipe for a dictatorship. Under questioning from Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's lawyer John Sauer conceded that some of the actions Trump allegedly took were private acts. But even supposedly official acts, such as Trump's alleged effort to enlist the Justice Department in an attempt to overturn the election, were allegedly part of what former Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben, representing the government, called an integrated conspiracy, in which the former president allegedly used his official powers and his private conduct to try to subvert the election. Dreeben discussed the distinction between acts as a president seeking re-election takes as an office holder and those he takes as an office seeker. The court should recognize that a president can be acting as an office seeker, or in Trump's case, someone seeking to hold on to an office after losing an election, even when his official duties are involved. The court should hand down its decision that would allow Trump's trial to proceed, and it should do so quickly. The court has taken far too much time in dealing with Trump's audacious immunity claim already, rejecting a plea by special counsel Jack Smith last year to consider the issue before an appeals court acted, and scheduling oral arguments on the last day of such proceedings. It would be wrong to think of an expeditious ruling in this case as an anti-Trump gesture. A ruling that allowed Trump to go on trial before the election could politically benefit the former president if he were acquitted. The real beneficiaries of a trial before November would be the voters, who deserve to know whether a candidate for the nation's highest office has been found innocent or guilty by a jury. The Los Angeles Times. We'll now be reading articles from the Longmont Times call, TC's Tip. Dear TC, someone from EcoCycle recently came to my work to give a presentation, and I learned about how valuable aluminum is and how important it is to recycle it. Since then, I've been pulling aluminum out of the trash when I see it. My question is, when is aluminum not recyclable? When should I leave it in the trash if I see it beckoning to me? Trash Diver. Dear Diver, you're right. Aluminum is gold in the recycling bin, and we shouldn't let it go to waste. I salute and thank you for redirecting this valuable material into a recycling bin. As long as people like you continue to return aluminum to a recycling bin, it is infinitely recyclable. Making a product from recycled aluminum saves a whopping 95% of the energy it takes to make it from virgin bauxite ore. Sourcing bauxite ore has a huge environmental and social footprint. It usually involves clear-cutting and burning trees, polluting waterways, and destroying habitat for many species, including humans. So keeping the aluminum we already have in circulation is critical. I, too, am unable to resist a dive if I see aluminum glinting from a trash bin after doing a safety check. Aluminum comes in a variety of forms, so let's talk about aluminum recycling guidelines. Recyclable. Aluminum cans, please empty and rinse and do not flatten. Aluminum pie pans, catering trays, and bowls, like from a burrito bowl. New ball aluminum cups seen at CU games and events around the country. And clean aluminum foil in a ball 2 inches or larger. Not recyclable. Peel back lids from yogurt containers, coffee containers, or chips in a tub may look like aluminum but are actually mostly plastic. Shiny chip packaging may also look like foil, but it too is mostly plastic. Aluminum recycling tips. Do not flatten aluminum cans or foil. The sorting machinery in the Boulder County Recycling Center may mistakenly identify two-dimensional aluminum as paper due to its flatness. To ensure flattened aluminum cans or foil aren't mistakenly identified as paper, ball the aluminum and give a flattened can a bend or a twist to create a three-dimensional shape before recycling. Collect small pieces of aluminum foil, like individual foil chocolate wrappers, and add them to a larger ball of foil until it is at least 2 inches in diameter before recycling. Smaller pieces of foil fall through the cracks in processing machinery. Peel off food from aluminum foil and give the foil a quick rinse before recycling it. Food residue on any containers attracts rodents, exposes recycling center workers to mold and wasps, and contaminates other materials. Do not put large pieces of scrap aluminum, like aluminum siding, in your single-stream recycling. Take them to a scrap metal recycler, such as the EcoCycle Center for Hard-to-Recycle Materials, CHARM. I hope you now feel equipped to rescue recyclable aluminum and educate those around you so it gets recycled correctly in the first place. TC. Got zero waste questions? We have answers. Email ecocycle@ecocycle.org, rosie@ecocycle.org, call 303-444-6634, check the EcoCycle A to Z Recycling app, or visit ecocycle.org. Honoring veterans. Hundreds gather for honor flight send-off. 120 veterans from Northern Colorado boarded the flight to see the D.C. memorials by Jocelyn Rowley. A program originally founded to help World War II veterans in Northern Colorado marked a new chapter on Sunday. For the first time in its history, the High Plains Honor Flight, taking veterans to visit memorials in Washington, D.C., did not include anyone who served during that conflict, a milestone that was expected but still sad to note, retired Colonel Skip Johnson told a crowd at the ranch on Sunday. We knew that this day was coming just with the passage of time, he said, but we stand on the greatest generation's shoulders. Johnson was the final speaker at a send-off event for the 120 veterans taking part in this year's High Plains Honor Flight. Of those, 106 served during the Vietnam War, 6 during the Korean War, and 1 served in both. Johnson addressed the Vietnam War veterans directly during his remarks, apologizing for their treatment from civilians following their return from overseas. You may not know this, but you changed this country, he said. You came home in the darkest days of our cultural society, and you woke this country up. This will never happen again. Since 2005, the nonprofit Honor Flight Network and its 128 nationwide hubs have flown 275,000 veterans to Washington, D.C. at no charge to give them a chance to see in person the monuments and memorials erected to honor their service. In 2008, retired U.S. Army Colonel Stan Cass founded Northern Colorado Honor Flight to serve veterans from the region, including Wyoming and Nebraska. Over 10 years, the organization organized 22 trips for close to 3,000 veterans. Northern Colorado Honor Flight ceased operations in 2018 following Cass's death, but the next year, several of his volunteers reconstituted the organization as High Plains Honor Flight to carry on his mission. Sunday's trip marked High Plains' 4th since forming in 2019. In addition to the 120 veterans, 60 guardians also participated. After a whirlwind tour, the group will return on Monday. Hundreds of friends, family members, and well-wishers gathered in the McKee Building beforehand to celebrate the occasion. In addition to Johnson, the high-spirited crowd also heard from State Rep. Ryan Argonost of Berthoud, a former Marine who served in Iraq. He reminded those going on the trip that the length of your life matters less than what you do with it. The memories you have and that you made are what matters, Armagost said, and what you are doing today is one of those memories that you will carry with you the rest of your life. Following the ceremony, dozens of motorcyclists formed an escort to guide four buses from the ranch to Northern Colorado Regional Airport, while hundreds of spectators lined the route, waving flags and signs. Hawaii. Family avoids tap water at home after jet fuel leaks. By Jennifer Cinco Kelleher, the Associated Press. Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. Rochelle Dietz, a mother of two and a wife of a U.S. Navy officer, often thinks about water. The family stationed in Honolulu spends more than $120 a month on jugs of bottled water for drinking, cooking, and cleaning, as well as showerhead and sink filters. Each night, the children, aged 13 and 5, carry cups of bottled water upstairs to their bathrooms to brush their teeth. I hope that one day I cannot think about water all the time, Dietz said, but right now it's a constant. That vigilance is to avoid more vomiting, diarrhea, rashes, and other ailments, which they said started experiencing in 2021 when jet fuel leaked into the Navy water system serving 93,000 people on and around the Pearl Harbor base. It sickened thousands in military housing, including Dietz says her own family. She's one of the 17 relatives of U.S. military members suing the United States over the leak from the World War II era storage tanks. She said her entire family, including dog Rocket, continues to suffer from health problems they link to the tainted water. Her husband, a chief petty officer, declined to be interviewed by the Associated Press because he fears retaliation from the Navy. The 17 are considered bellwether plaintiffs, representing more than 7,500 other military family members, civilians, and service members in three federal lawsuits. The outcome of their trial, which starts Monday, will help determine the success of other cases and damages that could be awarded. Christina Baer, one of their attorneys, said she already considers it a success because the U.S. government has admitted liability. U.S. Department of Justice attorneys wrote in court documents that the government admits the November 20th, 2021 spill at the Red Hill Bulk Fuel Storage Facility caused a nuisance for the plaintiffs, that the United States breached its duty of care, and that the plaintiffs suffered compensable injuries. But they dispute the plaintiffs were exposed to jet fuel at levels high enough to cause their alleged health problems. Lingering issues plaintiffs say they are battling include seizures, memory loss, anxiety, eczema, and asthma. When the Dietz family arrived in Hawaii in February 2021, we thought we were moving to heaven on earth, Dietz wrote in a declaration filed in the case. But around Thanksgiving, soon after the leak, they couldn't figure out their stomach pain, vomiting, and diarrhea. Other families in the neighborhood were also sick. Then they developed rashes. My throat is burning. I feel like I just drank gasoline, Dietz remembers telling her husband on November 27th. The next night, her Facebook timeline was filled with neighbors complaining about the smell of fuel in their water. The Dietzes ran to their faucets and smelled fuel, too. They noticed the tap water also had an oily sheen. Attorneys representing the family say the trial will show Navy officers failed to warn residents after learning about fuel in the water and even maintained that staff members were drinking the water. Navy representatives and government attorneys did not respond to an email seeking comment on the lawsuit. The fuel storage tanks have long been a flashpoint in Hawaii, with Native Hawaiians and other residents raising concerns over the past decade about leaks that threatened the broader water supply. The tank sits above an aquifer that delivers water to 400,000 people in urban Honolulu. At first, the Navy said it hadn't determined how much petroleum got into the water, but its own investigation eventually pinned the cause to a cascading series of mistakes. On May 6, 2021, a pipe ruptured due to an operator error and caused 21,000 gallons of fuel that was being transferred between tanks to spill. Most of the fuel, however, entered a fire suppression line and remained there until 6 months later, when a cart rammed into the line and released 20,000 gallons that eventually got into the water system. Red Hill workers noticed that one of the tanks was short that amount, but did not report the discrepancy to senior leadership. Dietz didn't want to risk her husband's career by asking to leave Hawaii, so they stayed and were committed to avoiding tap water while they figured out their next steps. They're just going to put another family in this house, she said, so we need to stay here and we need to try to fight to get this fixed. In doing so, Dietz said she found unexpected allies among Native Hawaiians who revere water as a sacred resource and already have a distrust of the U.S. military, which can be traced back to at least 1893, when a group of American businessmen with support from the U.S. Marines overthrew the Hawaiian kingdom. Ukraine. Army's chief reports tactical retreat, by Susie Bland, the Associated Press. Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukraine's troops have been forced to make a tactical retreat from three villages in the embattled east, the country's army chief said Sunday, warning of worsening battlefield situations as Ukrainian forces wait for much-needed arms from a huge U.S. aid package to reach combat zones. Colonel General Oleksandr Sirsky reported that Russian forces continue to attack along the entire front line of more than 620 miles, with pitched battles raging west of Avdiivka, the eastern city they took in February after a grueling months-long fight. The most difficult situation is in the Pokrovsk and Kurovsky directions, where fierce battles continue, Sirsky said in an update posted to the Telegram messaging app, referencing two Ukraine-held cities in the war-torn Donetsk region, once a hub of industry. The enemy has engaged up to four brigades in these directions and is trying to develop an offensive west of Avdiivka and Marinka, making its way to Pokrovsk and Kurakov, Sirsky added. Units of the defensive forces of Ukraine, preserving the lives and health of our defenders, moved to new frontiers west of Berchy, Semenivka, and Novomkiva. Two of these frontline villages lie less than 31 miles east of Pokrovsk, while the third is located just more than 19 miles from the road to Kurakov. A Washington-based think tank predicted late Saturday that Russian forces will likely make significant tactical gains in the coming weeks as acute ammunition shortages continue to hobble Ukraine's defense efforts. In its latest operational assessment, the Institute for the Study of War said that Moscow's forces have opportunities to push forward around Avdiivka and also threaten nearby Chasiv Yar. Its capture would give Russia control of a hilltop from which it can attack other key cities, forming the backbone of Ukraine's eastern defenses. Despite this, the think tank assessed that neither of these efforts by Moscow are likely to cause Kyiv's defense lines to collapse in the near term. The Russian Defense Ministry on Sunday confirmed that Moscow's troops had taken a village about 9 miles north of Avdiivka, days after the War Institute reported on its likely capture early on Thursday. That day's assessment described Moscow's gains as relatively quick but still relatively marginal, adding that Russian troops had advanced by no more than 3 miles over the previous week. U.S. President Joe Biden promised on Wednesday that U.S. weapons shipments would begin making their way into Ukraine within hours as he signed into law a $95 billion measure, $61 billion of which was allocated for Ukraine. That also included assistance for Israel, Taiwan, and other global hotspots. The announcement marked an end to the long, painful battle with Republicans in Congress over urgently needed assistance for Ukraine. Elsewhere, Russian drones struck the Ukrainian Black Sea city of Mykolaiv early Sunday, setting a hotel ablaze and damaging infrastructure, according to local officials. Vitaly Kim, the governor of Ukraine's southern Mykolaiv province, said the drone seriously damaged a hotel in its namesake capital, sparking a fire that was later extinguished. Kim also reported that the strike damaged heat-generating infrastructure in the city. He also added that there were no casualties. Russian state agency RIA reported that the strike on Mykolaiv targeted a shipyard where naval drones are assembled as well as hotel housing, housing English-speaking mercenaries who have fought for Kyiv. The RIA report cited Sergei Lebedev, described as a coordinator of local pro-Moscow guerrillas. His comments could not be independently verified. Also on Sunday morning, the Russian Defense Ministry said that 17 Ukrainian drones were downed overnight over four regions in the country's southwest. Three drones were intercepted near an oil depot in Ludinova, an industrial town about 143 miles north of the Ukrainian border, Governor Vladislav Shapsha said. One of the Ukrainian drones damaged communications infrastructure in Russia's southern Belgorod province, which borders Ukraine, Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov said later on Sunday. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The Russian Defense Ministry claimed Sunday that its forces had destroyed ammunition depots and military equipment housed at least three airports across Ukraine, including assault drones stored at Kamianka Airfield in the country's east. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily Camera and Longmont Times Call, read by Anita Head.
Hello, you are listening to the Boulder County News. My name is Leslie Madsen. We will start with news from Louisville. Louisville Council hears update on city's recovery from Marshall Fire. The Louisville City Council heard updates about Marshall Fire recovery, going over recovery efforts and mitigation efforts the city and community are taking. According to the Louisville website, as of April 22nd, of the 550 homes and businesses lost in the fire, 203 units are under construction, 202 have received certificates of occupancy, and 19 rebuild permits are being reviewed. At the April 16th council meeting, Recovery and Resilience Manager Kiana Freeman said that her division has been working on a disaster management program with the goal of leading Marshall Fire recovery while implementing resilience, helping the community build back stronger. The Marshall Fire swept through Boulder County, Superior, and Louisville on December 30th, 2021. Part of the recovery efforts that the Recovery and Resilience Division is doing is supporting not just the physical rebuild, but all of the efforts going on, Freeman said. Freeman said the city will partner with Superior for the Disaster Preparedness Education Series, which the city also hosted last summer. The series focused on a different topic each month to educate the community on preparedness and increase resilience. On May 23rd, Boulder County will host a webinar to go over updates regarding the Community Wildfire Protection Plan, which identifies and prioritizes ways to reduce wildfire risks. This plan was last updated in 2011, and according to the Boulder County website, the new plan will be completed this year. More information is available at louisvilleco.gov. And as you may know, the Recovery and Resilience Division also works to connect residents with mental health partners and Jewish Family Services for any support needed. Freeman said the city will continue to evaluate any other mental health resources the community may need. The city has received 385 city use tax credit requests, which is available to property owners whose property was destroyed or sustained significant damage after the Marshall Fire. The city has issued over $5 million in credits, and the average cost of construction for residents rebuilding is a little over $900,000. In December 2023, the council passed an ordinance to allow residents whose homes were damaged by sustained smoke, heat, water, ash, or other damage due to the fire to exempt construction materials from the city's use tax and allow those residents to opt out of the 2021 building codes when rebuilding. Before, only homes that were significantly damaged or destroyed in the fire were exempt. Director of Finance Ryder Bailey said fire-related expenses have cost the city $29.8 million, but the city is anticipating recovering approximately 75% of those costs, with the majority coming from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. The remaining costs not externally covered, approximately $8.1 million, comes from unrecoverable losses like business income loss or disaster-related expenses, which are not covered by FEMA. Freeman said the Public Works Department is continuing to monitor streets and sidewalks as construction progresses. The Parks and Open Space Department have completed repairing all amenities damaged in the fire and are continuing to work on replacing the landscape on damaged areas. The Louisville Fire Protection District is also working with local fire departments and districts and the county to implement new response protocols for wildfires. The city is also taking precautions to minimize possible fuel for fire by managing open space areas with mowing, cattle grazing, and removal of woody fuels. And in more Louisville news, Louisville Cemetery cleanup ensures veterans' resting spots are tidy. The American Legion Post 111 in Louisville is hosting a cemetery cleanup in an effort to honor local war veterans. The event will be held at the Louisville Cemetery, 2105 Empire Road, from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. this Saturday. Volunteers must sign a waiver before working, but can do so at between 9 and 9:50 a.m. at the cemetery. Pam Motorano is Post 111 event chair and said the American Legion posts offer events and resources for veterans to help veterans. Although Louisville does a great job of maintaining the cemetery, she said, Saturday's cleanup is a way to complete detailed work and ensure that no grave is missed. As a community, the event is a good way to honor those who are resting in peace there and to make sure that they have grounds that are well cared for, Motorano said. She also hopes the event will help the community see the importance of honoring veterans' legacies, histories, and lives. Volunteers are asked to bring their own gardening supplies and gloves. We'll also clean up trash and markers from headstones and will ensure that no weeds or grass is covering names. Motorano said the event helps the community ensure the final resting grounds of veterans remain beautiful. Plus, volunteers can pay their respects while getting to know Post 111's veteran members. There's more information on Facebook under Post 111 Louisville. Oh, in addition, this is important. Post 111 at this volunteer event, be there by 9:30 this Saturday, as the Post will also provide food, drinks, and a bathroom for all volunteers. Louisville plans to leave Airport Noise Group, saying it has no teeth. Louisville officials want to leave the Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport Community Noise Roundtable, or dissolve the group, saying that it has done little to address resident concerns about noise. The Louisville City Council voted unanimously on Tuesday to direct Roundtable Liaison Council Member Deborah Faye to vote to leave or dissolve the group at the next Roundtable meeting, which is scheduled for May 2nd. The Roundtable is a voluntary group made up of people from neighboring communities, federal and state agencies, airport administrators, and airport users. It's meant to address noise concerns related to the airport on Airport Way southwest of Louisville. The Jefferson County government has owned and operated the airport since 1960. Fahey on Tuesday echoed the same sentiments as the Superior Board of Trustees' April 8th discussion about possibly dissolving the roundtable, pointing out that the roundtable group has no authority over the airport. The FAA agency, the RMMA Airport Advisory Board, and Jefferson County make decisions about flight routes, noise mitigation, what kind of fuel pilots can use, among other things, she said. The roundtable has no say. We can request, but we have no authority, Fahey said. At the same time, Jefferson County commissioners approved a noise study at a meeting on Tuesday. The FAA Part 150 noise study is a voluntary program by the FAA that sets guidelines for airport operators to document noise exposure and establish noise abatement and land use codes around the airport. Fahey said the study will provide information on noise impacts from the airport, but that it's expected to take 2 years to complete and an estimated 20 years to implement, whatever the study findings show. The noise study will be done whether or not the roundtable group dissolves or not, she said. Jefferson County officials will oversee the study, but Louisville staffers and residents can participate in it by going to Jefferson County meetings. Other city council members said a Louisville resident had other negative things to say about the airport at Tuesday's meeting. Council member Dietrich Hoffner pointed to information in a Superior and Boulder County lawsuit against Jefferson County that indicates that A former airport director said, "I want several communities to waste their money and time with the roundtable process." Hoffner said that he recognizes that the former airport director no longer works at RMMA and a new director is being recruited, but that the statement indicates the roundtable is not serving the community. Josh Cooperman, who ran for mayor in 2023, said the roundtable does not accurately represent the Louisville community, and comments from the previous airport director show that not everyone on the roundtable participated in good faith.